Welcome to Health Cetera Radio, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. This is pediatric nurse practitioner Christy Westfall, pondering today about ways to help the average, everyday person better engage in their own health care. The Affordable Health Care Act, also known as Obamacare, strives to improve access to care, and precision medicine emphasizes the need to tailor health care for individuals. Transparency also remains a theme. Along with access, understanding, and a focus on individualized care, there is also a call for each of us to become more engaged in caring for ourselves. Joining me today is Dr. George Demiris to help unpack some of the existing opportunities within health technology to help bring your health more into your home. Dr. Demiris joins us from the University of Washington, where he is both faculty and an expert researcher in health and medical informatics. Thank you so much for chatting today, Dr. Demiris.
Thank you for inviting me.
I've heard you say that technology remains a new reality to healthcare and that informatics is here to stay. So, what exactly is health informatics? Is it just in the hospital, or is it something that also might be present in our homes?
Health informatics is the study of the use of information technology in healthcare. And so that actually reaches a very wide spectrum. It includes the hospital, but it also includes the home setting, various communities, but even interventions at the public health level, and even at the molecular level. So health informatics is really the discipline that examines all aspects of care from bench to bedside and tries to improve quality of care and outcomes through the use of information technology.
How did you get interested in health informatics?
I was always interested in biology and medicine and wanted to explore the healthcare field more, but I didn't feel like I had the strength to be a clinician. I was more interested in the process of healthcare and how we can improve healthcare services. I was also interested in information technology and computer science and wanted to explore how we can design new innovative tools to find new solutions for old problems in healthcare. So I was very excited to find that there is actually a whole dedicated domain that examines those challenges, and I guess that's how I ended up in the field.
So you seem to be the perfect person to ask my really big question. What exactly is big data? We hear those two words thrown around in the healthcare community so often, but what exactly does it mean?
So big data really refers to a new reality. We have now so many technologies. We use computers for all our transactions. We have wearable technologies to measure things that we couldn't measure before. And as a result, we end up with data that keep growing in size, so much so that the traditional methods we had in the past to analyze and process them are not sufficient. And so by calling them big data, we're really referring to very large data sets that have a lot of hidden knowledge, but we need to find the right algorithms and right ways to process them to figure out what new information we can extract.
So my mind goes straight to my smartphone and health apps and Fitbits. And when you mention this big data concept and how there's just so much information running around that we can potentially look at, it seems to me that people do seem to be collecting a lot of health information on themselves. So when did this quantified self movement start, and what implications do you think it might hold for helping us to better manage our health?
You know, as technologies became more cost-effective and more pervasive, more and more people started using them, like you said, to measure their physical activity, how much they're eating, how much they're exercising, how well they're sleeping. We can use our phone, we can use other wearable devices to really get more and more information about our daily living. And many people are fascinated by the ability to be able to track all those data around your daily living. We can now measure not only what is happening in our body, but what is happening in our environment, the level of noise or temperature in a room. And quantified self is really a movement that basically describes this effort to use various wearable sensors and other technologies to measure things that have to do with our well-being, whether it is have to do with physical activity or nutrition or even the quality of the air we breathe. I think this is a movement that obviously emerged as we started seeing more and more of the wearable devices become more readily available for people, and it's definitely a movement that's here to stay. It has implications for healthcare. People become more engaged and in their own healthcare by being able to monitor themselves what is going on with their body. Right now, however, we don't have yet the right framework to make sense of the data, meaning that an individual can collect all the data, but they are not necessarily able to provide the data to their healthcare provider or to the clinical site that they utilize. We really don't have the framework yet to be able to allow providers to process the data. There's a lot of questions around accountability, liability, and what providers should be doing with these data sets. So right now, there's still a lot of legal and practical questions that need to be resolved. Perhaps in the future, when we have the right framework in place, we can use a lot of the data that we collect on our own about ourselves in a meaningful way, where we provide aggregate summaries of what's going on with our lives to our healthcare providers, who can then use that data if and when it's appropriate.
So I'm going to continue using my Fitbit and also taking a look at my iPhone apps and maybe, just maybe, taking a look at some personal health records as well. So I know that I have a personal health record because my primary care provider that I have has hooked me up with one, and the patients that I see in my own primary care practice as a pediatric nurse practitioner also have access to this. How are these patient portals something that are moving forward in technology and helping people to further become engaged in their health?
You know, I think personal health records are really changing the way we deliver care. Unlike the traditional electronic medical record systems that are only accessible to clinicians and staff within a clinical setting, personal health records are applications that really allow patients themselves to not only view their data, but in many cases enter new data and decide who they want to share the data with. Many personal health record applications are standalone applications, which means you can use it regardless of what your insurance is or who your healthcare provider is. Those are software applications that you use to store your data and share with clinicians or your family. In some instances, healthcare systems provide you with patient portals, and those are in many cases linked to the provider or your insurance system. But those are also very powerful in that they allow patients to have direct access to their own health information, something that was not easy to establish before, and patients were often struggling with even getting basic information about their health care since the electronic medical record was really not accessible to them.
The internet continues to amaze me, and it continues to offer multiple opportunities for patients to get access to their healthcare and for people to just become more engaged, more active, and more aware. So that also brings me to the topic of telehealth. It's a hot topic in legislation right now. It's a hot topic in healthcare. What is telehealth? How exactly does it work?
Telehealth is really the use of technology to bridge geographic distance. So we use the technology to deliver care when all the different participants are not at the same place at the same time. So, for example, if we use video conferencing to bridge somebody in a rural area, in a community setting, or in their home with a healthcare provider at the remote site so that they can communicate, that would be an example of a telehealth visit. It would be the use of technology to create a virtual visit, unlike the in-person encounter. The idea behind that is that you can provide better access to specialized care. You can, as I mentioned, bridge the geographic distance. And when there's not many resources for travel, to have clinicians travel all those different sites, this could be an efficient solution for people to have access to specialized care.
Absolutely. I would love to see telehealth expand both in the rural communities as well as in the mental health and the palliative healthcare arenas. So what are your thoughts on some of the legislative potential towards getting more momentum for reimbursement for this type of healthcare?
There is definitely growing interest in establishing reimbursement for telehealth services, and reimbursement does vary by discipline and by state. I think it's important for us to have evidence that telehealth solutions work as well as traditional care, or in some cases even better. But we need to have that evidence to make sure that we can actually treat those interventions, if you will, the same way we would do an in-person encounter. And in some cases, that entails a lot of research studies that have large number of participants, so we can see how clinical outcomes improve and how they may or may not differ between a group that uses standard care and a group that uses telehealth. Or in some cases, there is no standard care because there's nothing else available, so we need to demonstrate that having telehealth is actually improving healthcare for a population that's otherwise underserved. Once we have that body of evidence, that there's still work that needs to be done in terms of seeking reimbursement, because we have a very structured process, and sometimes changing practice takes a long time. Even after the research has proven that something works, many times it takes years for that change to happen. I think it's important for all of us who believe that this may be a cost-effective alternative tool to think of all practical, ethical, and clinical implications, and then be advocates for a solution that is meaningful, that improves outcomes and improves access to care. And that's how I believe legislators will become more aware of the challenges and the opportunities.
So those of you out there that may be looking to see telehealth in your everyday homes and everyday life, write your legislators, let them know that this is something that you're in support of. I remain optimistic. Thank you for staying tuned to Health Cetera Radio. This is Christy Westfall chatting health informatics with expert Dr. George Demiris about ways that technology can help you stay healthy. We've talked about the quantified self. We've talked about personal health records. We've also talked some telehealth. Now we're going to shift to Dr. Demiris' fascinating research on the concept of the smart home. So, what is a smart home?
Well, a smart home is a residence that's equipped with technologies that are part of its infrastructure so that it can passively monitor the residence. This whole notion started becoming more prevalent in the 80s when people started thinking about energy-efficient buildings. So at that time, smart homes were buildings that actually had technology embedded to waste less energy. But some of the same technologies can actually be used to monitor if people are moving around in their home, if they have a high quality of life, or if they have experienced any emergencies. So in more recent years, we see that those same smart home technologies are being used with the goal to monitor overall wellness of people in their home, and especially for older adults, where the idea is that we could use the technology to support people so that they can stay independent in the residence of their choice for as long as possible.
So with this innovative redesign for home health care, what are some of the ways that you think this might help benefit the everyday person?
Well, when you think about smart home technologies, we're talking primarily about sensors. We can install motion sensors, stove sensors, gate monitors, pressure mats, a series of technologies that can be hopefully installed in a non-intrusive way. And the information we get from these types of technologies has to do with activities of daily living. So we can monitor whether somebody woke up, whether they're preparing their breakfast, what they're doing during the day. The goal here is not to monitor people just so that we can understand what they're doing, but rather to detect whether certain things change over time. For example, if somebody becomes less active over time, or if somebody's sleep quality decreases over time, they sleep fewer hours, they're more restless, there's something wrong with them, and it's sometimes not easy to find out what it is, but the data show us that there might be some abnormalities. Another example where this can be useful is when somebody has fallen and the system can detect that type of emergency immediately so that the right people can be notified. Smart homes can be used to both prevent, predict, and detect those types of adverse events or emergencies. And so the goal is to use the data to overall improve safety and well-being.
So I'm going to play the role of conspiracy theorist here and ask you, what are your thoughts about security and privacy associated with these technologic advancements in the home? I mean, couldn't this be possibly intrusive to one's privacy?
Absolutely. I think this is a great question and a very important consideration when we think about home-based technologies. We need to make sure that we have the right safeguards in place. We need to follow the right protocols to encrypt our servers and protect the safety, the security of the data. There are various mechanisms we can have in place to maximize the protection of one's privacy. However, it is always a concern because things could go wrong. Privacy is an important consideration, and it has to do not only with how secure the data are, and in many cases there are safeguards that can maximize that security, but it's also how one subjectively feels about being monitored in their home. And that can definitely feel intrusive. So we have to find the right balance between what people are willing to have measured about them, who they want to share data with, and when and how and why. There has to be a perceived need, and also people may feel more comfortable with one technology over another. So all that has to be taken into consideration. We need to make sure when we design the systems that they do not only accurately detect what they're supposed to be detecting, but also that they're not undesirable or intrusive to individuals. So we really need to assess what people's preferences and needs are. A lot of people appreciate monitoring technologies in their home, not only because it gives them a way to feel more safe in their home, but also because they can communicate with their healthcare provider or their family members and discuss what is going on with their health. Other people feel that they do not need or do not want that type of monitoring, and that is perfectly fine. We really need to come up with tailored solutions that work for the individual needs. Some smart home systems are used for people with dementia where it's hard to assess their own consent, and so we work with families to figure out what would be the best solution. And this is a very challenging situation because we need to honor the individual's wish and preferences. So it's definitely an important area, and one I think we need to continue examining, because it's an important issue when we think about one's own home, which is a place we all want to feel safe but also private.
I'm so grateful that you've taken the time to kind of unpack how current technologies we have today have really worked to improve health accessibility, health quality, and just help people become more engaged in their health care. Do you have any ideas for future research that you might be starting to think about or starting to work on that you'd like to share?
Yes, we have two projects that we're currently involved in that I'm very excited about. The first one looks at caregivers of hospice patients. Those are the informal caregivers, the family members, spouses or others who are taking care of a loved one at the end of life.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what hospice means?
Yes, hospice is basically a service provided to people who have a terminal illness with a prognosis of 6 months to live or less. So the focus within hospice care is palliation, to provide high quality and as much relief from pain and dignity for people at the end of life and their families. This type of service is essential for people with a terminal condition, but we heavily rely on the caregivers to actually assume most of the caregiving tasks. So the family members who are engaged in that role are really carrying out a lot of activities. They're often very stressed out. They have to deal with an emotionally challenging time, but also with the physical challenges of caregiving. And if you look at the literature, oftentimes caregivers feel that they don't have enough support, they don't have enough information about what they're supposed to do, and they rate communication with healthcare providers as poor. Studies have shown that caregivers of terminally ill patients have their own mortality and morbidity affected through that experience. So we're trying to figure out solutions to support caregivers during these challenging times. In our most current research project, we have been trying to look at the role of video conferencing to support caregivers. And that support can be done in two ways. One is to have somebody provide support services. In this case, it's a problem-solving therapy intervention. But by using the video, we actually save resources, whereas with traditional care, you would have to add home visits. And the other way we're trying to support caregivers is through the use of video to have them become virtual team members of the interdisciplinary hospice team meeting.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much for your time. You've taught us just exactly what health informatics is, what big data is, and how technology can actually help people to become more engaged in their own health. Thank you so much for the research that you do and all of the people that your work is going to help make their lives better. If any of us would like to continue to follow your work or learn more about what you do, how can we follow you and how can we get in a hold of you?
We have two websites. One is for the Hospice Caregiving Research Network that describes some of the work I just mentioned. And the URL for that is hospice-research.org. And the second website is called HealthE, and that describes various technology and aging initiatives we have at the University of Washington. The URL for that is health-e.info.
I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the Western Institute of Nursing, as well as the University of Washington, and of course, again, the wonderful Dr. Damiris. So health informatics and health technology may seem like big words or intangible concepts. Today's show makes it real how health and technology can combine to bring health opportunities into your home, help make us more aware and more accountable for our own health, identify some of the life patterns that may actually place us at risk for health problems, improve our communication with ourselves and our health providers, and help improve our everyday health. Health technology, helping to set the stage for all of us to better health engage.